On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us,
the Murray family, at mauramurrayfamilydirect@gmail.com,
or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray.
Welcome back to Missing Maura Murray. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing all right, Lance. And as you well know, the 16-year anniversary of Maura's disappearance is coming up this Sunday on February 9th, 2020. And for this episode, we have Julie Murray, Maura's sister, on to discuss all things Maura's case. And of course, if you haven't heard Julie on True Crime Garage recently, check that out. The two episodes came out last week, so that's a good primer, a good case discussion with Julie Murray.
Yep. Unfortunately, Tim, this has become a tradition where we talk to Julie every year around this time, around the anniversary of Maura's disappearance, and we're at the 16-year mark. And I remember starting this, you know, we were looking at it and saying, like, wow, I can't believe it's 11 years. I can't believe it's 12 years. Well, I can't believe it's been 16 years. And some of the stuff that we discussed with Julie, I would have never guessed that we'd be discussing it at this point. So it makes for a very interesting listen. But keep in mind that this whole venture that we're going on is about finding out what happened to a young woman who went missing in New Hampshire. And there's a lot of distractions along the way, and we're just trying to plug through. And I think listening to Julie's words, you'll understand that she and her family are also trying to push through all this. She even said that during this interview when we asked how the family was doing, and she said they're just plugging along. They're just trying to get by. And that is something that I think should be taken a little bit more into consideration, the mental well-being of the family and how they're just trying to figure things out as they go.
I agree. I think it's easy to forget how hard of a situation it is to be put in for them, you know, and they are just trying their best, and you know, they don't know what to do. So
exactly. And we're not guilty of it either. You know, there are times when we maybe let emotions get the better of us and we start to lose track a little bit, but we do our best to get back on track, and I hope that is apparent, you know, when we make those efforts.
I hope so too. And Lance, so for the 16th anniversary, like we've done over the past few years, we're going to do a candle lighting social media push. So we're going to light up the world on February 9th. So take a picture of yourself, of a candle, tweet it out, tag us, send it on Instagram, on Facebook, and hashtag Find Maura. And tag us, tag the official pages, tag the family pages. And I think that'd be a nice tribute for Maura.
And for those of you who don't know, Julie Murray started a GoFundMe for Maura. It is GoFundMe.com/Maura Murray Missing, or you could go to GoFundMe.com and just search Maura Murray, and you'll see the Julie Murray campaign effort. It's raised quite a bit of money at this point. They had to up their goal. This money is to be used for testing, for future searches, to acquire any forensic evidence, basically anything that is coming from independent searches or anything that maybe private investigators or law enforcement needs a little assistance with. So go to GoFundMe, search Maura Murray, and the campaign is the one that Julie Murray has started. And yeah, make sure you give there, and you know, you'll know that your money is going for a good cause.
Okay, everybody, thank you very much for listening, as always, and we hope you enjoy the interview with Julie Murray. How are you, Julie Murray?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Julie. As you know, you're more than welcome to join us anytime. Any topic that you want to discuss is on the table. One thing that I would like to put out there before we get into any new searches or anything like that is the new push for funding and the new GoFundMe campaign that you recently took over. I think it was last week or a couple of weeks ago. Do you want to talk about that for a little bit?
We decided that we wanted to get some of the samples that we previously obtained from the searches done over the last couple of years. Most people know that we did conduct several searches with trained professionals. We had GB Geotechnics on there doing the ground penetrator radar. We also had cadaver dogs at multiple locations. So we really obtained a lot of good samples. The second part to that was we had never tested them. So now we want to move into that phase two of actually testing those samples in a lab setting to see if we can pull any DNA off any of those samples. So I'm really excited about it. We had another round of searches this past fall where we just added to some of those samples. And we're hoping that we can either rule those out or, you know, come up with something that might help us find Mara.
Julie, you mentioned samples. What kind of samples are going to be tested?
That's a good question. So on the previous searches, we've got all kinds of samples. We've got soil samples from particular areas of interest. We have concrete samples, fabric samples, wood samples, pretty much anything that we thought would be valuable, we got samples of. And those samples we've held those in the condition that we obtained them in. And now we're just, like I said, we're going to phase two and actually testing those.
And these were samples that were discovered, or these were samples that were collected over the course of a couple of years, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So the main objective of phase one and the first GoFundMe was to check out some of these areas of interest, some of which the community knows about, and you've reported on those areas, some of which I'm not able to talk about because there are people that don't want their information out there online. And as you know, this case, it's an interesting case. And once people get a hold of something, they could start harassing different folks who are just trying to help. And we want to do everything that we can to protect those people. And they've been so kind and generous to even let us search their properties to begin with. The last thing I want to do, or my family wants to do, is to cause them any additional stress or, post their information online where people can then have a field day about, you know, speculating about who knows what.
Yeah, absolutely. And in addition to respecting their privacy and the, you know, the condition of their property, these people don't want anybody up there. We don't know how many locations were searched. Only you and a select few know the locations or location that was searched. But we want to just keep emphasizing and reemphasizing that this is for the privacy of the people there. Their community is tight-knit. They appreciate the fact that they are in a remote location and they don't have dark tourism going on. But additionally to that, this is anywhere you've searched is now, I guess, an unofficial crime scene, possibly. And if you actually want to contribute to finding some answers here, you have to know, like, if you go to a scene like this, if some sort of search is being kept preserved, don't go there and disrupt it. This is I feel like it's a really delicate time in the whole search process over the past 16 years. I feel like this might be one of the most delicate times. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And you're right. Some of the information that we've learned and some of the samples that we've obtained over the last 2 years are the most hopeful samples or the most hopeful chances that we've had. So I've said it before, it's kind of like an emotional roller coaster and you try to keep an even keel and keep your emotions kind of steady. But when you do get some kind of samples and some kind of hope, you try not to get too high or too low. And that's, you know, from my family standpoint, but also some of the areas that we searched have families who have children, and we want to make sure that we're protecting those children and the family and the property. But yeah, we're definitely really hopeful.
Great. And I imagine the first thing you want to do is share it with the public when you know that you have something positive.
Yeah, I want to scream it from the rooftop. I want to go up there and I am so excited. And I know that for me as a family member, it's one thing, and I'm so emotionally and attached to this case, but the community has become emotionally attached as well. And just look at the GoFundMe account that we started. In 3 days, the community stepped up in a big way and contributed over our initial goal of $5,000. And I owe it, and my family owes it to those people to let them know, hey, this is what we found, or this is what we didn't find, or this is what we ruled out. And it's definitely a community effort, and I understand that. And it's really hard for me not to scream it from the rooftops what I know right now, but I can't, because that's irresponsible of me to do that at this time. But, you know, rest assured, once I'm able to announce what I know or don't know or what we've ruled out, I'm very excited to do that.
So there is a new push for funds. This will be going towards testing. It'll be going towards future searches. You took the reins on this one. We had done the original one with Maggie, and you took the reins on this one. Why did you make that decision to start it with your name directly attached to the GoFundMe?
Well, there was two reasons, really. The searches that we recently did this past fall, as you know, I was contacting you guys directly saying, hey, I estimate we need this much to do this search. And you'd give me that much. And then I'd say, oh, wait a minute, we screwed up, we need more. And it was kind of this back and forth. And I really felt like I was annoying everyone. And I felt like, it might be better just for me to have direct access to it, so I don't have to do all that back and forth. And then there was transfer limits and things like that, some administrative things that could potentially cause a delay in obtaining the funds. But I just want to say that the previous efforts led by you guys and Maggie, I mean, those funds got us the samples that we have now to test. So I can't thank you and the community enough for stepping up and creating that. But going forward, I think it's just for logistics reasons, I think it's easier for just me to have direct access to it.
Yeah, I'll say that the word annoyed was not even in the realm of words that I personally would choose when you were asking for money. It was a huge, huge relief to see that money was needed, directly needed by you. Because that was, there's some movement. We didn't really need to know the details. And personally, I was ready to drive money directly up to you if you needed it, just to make it a little bit more, a little bit more expeditious. And you're right. It just makes a lot more sense for you to have the access when you need it. And if you have to estimate a certain amount that you need, you can just simply go to an ATM, or you can, you know, do a wire transfer to your own account or something. Just I think, like you said, the logistics behind you having it personally attached makes much more sense.
Yeah, and just one more thing on that. Also, the reason why, I mean, Maggie asked me if I wanted to have direct access to the funds back when we did the first one, and I was against it because I never wanted to. I didn't like the optics of the family having these funds raised by the community, and then, you know, people might say that we were using it not as we should. But then I thought about it. I'm like, that's crazy. Like, I'm using it to find my sister. So I'm not using it for any other purpose. And I want to make sure everyone knows that. And I make sure to keep every single receipt down to, you know, the penny. So we're definitely not using these funds for any other reason other than to find Mara. And my family and I have come out of pocket hundreds, thousands.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is not for profit for me. This is to find Mara.
Yeah. And yeah. I'll also say that it's not crazy of you to think that people would think that the money would be used in a way that is not conducive to the case.
Mm-hmm.
People will think that no matter what. So it's just the part of the fundraising efforts that unfortunately comes along with it. But you're keeping the receipts and things are getting done and samples are being mailed out. So the people who have donated to the first campaign and donated to the second campaign, awesome. That's money well spent.
Yeah, exactly. It's for your family to spend in searching for more in whatever way you think is the right way. So that's really, I think, the spirit of why it was started in the first place. And there is a link in the show notes. You can donate to this GoFundMe, or you can search Find Maura Murray on GoFundMe.com to donate yourself.
I have a question, Julie, about anything else the community can do aside from donations. If you have anything specific or maybe some sort of general effort that people can make in addition to or instead of making financial donations to help.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Mara's been missing for 16 years, and there's not many cases that are as widely known as Mara Murray for this long. 16 years is a long time, and I have to thank the community for keeping her story alive, and every chance I get, I try to do that. What I tell people who may not have the financial means to donate is to continue to talk about Mara. Keep talking. Keep asking the hard questions. Keep pounding away at small details, because that's what's going to break this case. And so you've heard me say it at CrimeCon, and I sound like a broken record, but I understand that most missing person cases die away and are lost in the, you know, in terms of being in the public view, and Mara's has not. And so it's definitely the community that's kept it alive. It's you guys, it's the Oxygen Show, it's different podcasts. And we just have to keep it going.
Yeah, totally agree. And one great showing of the community is when everyone comes together for the anniversary. Do you and your family have any plans for the anniversary?
Yes. So, like I said, February 9th, 2020 now, marks the 16th anniversary. And I think it was a couple years ago, we started a candle lighting vigil. I think I started that with you guys, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just a way for people who may not be in the area, people who want to participate, but can't get up there. It's kind of an odd time to go up there in February. So at 7:30 p.m. on February 9th, 2020, we asked the folks in the community to light a candle and then take a picture or a video and then share it to the Facebook page, the private group, or the public group, and we'll post that as soon as we can. And it's just a great way to what I like to call keep the sky lit up for Mara. for people that are in the area, we're going to have a little gathering at the Happy Hour restaurant that's in Wells River. I believe the address is 42 Main Street. But that is in Vermont, so it's right over the bridge there. So from 3 to 6, I'll be there. My dad will be there. Curtis will be there. Other members of my family will be there. Please come. If you're in the area, please stop by. Introduce yourself. Ask me whatever questions you have. I'd love to meet you in person. And then from there, we're going to go over to the Ribbon Tree at about 7:15, and we'll do a little vigil there, and then that'll be it. I do want to give a big thanks to the Happy Hour restaurant. They've always stepped up and supported us over the 16 years. They've had a lot of different characters come in and out of there to include my dad. They love my dad, and he loves them. So I talked to the owner, Tim, and he's very gracious and making that space available for us.
That's amazing. These are examples of how the community and how people can do something aside from financial donations. A simple gesture of 3 hours on a random night of the week in the middle of the winter is huge for something like this.
And I hear they have great food at the Happy Hour restaurant too. So go check it out if you're in the Wells River area of Vermont.
Julie, recently you discussed a theory on the 107 Degrees podcast about a speeding ticket that Maura may have been trying to clear up by going to New Hampshire. Is there anything that you want to elaborate on here, or maybe refresh people their memory on about this particular speeding ticket?
Yeah, I mean, first thing I want to say about theories in general is we don't know what happened to Maura, so this is just a theory. I'm not married to any particular theory or any one theory. There was some chatter online that I'm pushing a theory or certain people are pushing a theory. You really can't push a theory until you know what happened to Maura or until we find Maura. So Aaron Larkin of 107 Degree Podcast did several different FOIA right-to-know requests with the state of New Hampshire, and after many, many times and tries and being persistent, she was able to get a copy of a speeding ticket that Maura received the summer before she went missing, so in July. And the speeding ticket was issued in Hooksett, New Hampshire, which is kind of in the middle of Boston and Lincoln. And you guys correct me if I'm wrong, because you guys are there.
Yeah, it's southern New Hampshire. It's a little north of Manchester, but it's off 93. So we presume Maura went up 91 to the White Mountains. But this is on the other side. I don't know exactly how many miles, but it's one of the other major interstates going north.
Right. Okay. So basically, when I met with Chuck West and he asked me about the speeding ticket, and I had no idea. I was totally blindsided because I had no idea that she got a speeding ticket in July, the summer before. Mm-hmm. So I asked my dad, and like, Dad, do you remember the speeding ticket? And he's totally focused on where's Maura, 100%, 24/7. And he vaguely remembered maybe paying a speeding ticket, but it was kind of cloudy to him. So when Aaron was able to get the actual documentation, and then when Chuck West from the cold case unit asked me about it, we were kind of able to put some pieces together. And we learned that she paid the speeding ticket, but in New Hampshire, her license had to be reinstated even after the payment of the ticket. So
oh, God.
She would have to go in person to pay a reinstatement fee.
In person, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, in Concord. So we think that in the previous accident on that Saturday night in my dad's new car, when she was talking to the officer there, the officer may have brought it up when he ran her license and said, hey, do you know you have your license is suspended in New Hampshire?
Okay, so, that's
I mean, this is just a theory, so yeah. I don't know, but it's possible.
Yeah, that's a reasonable theory, and I apologize if this information's already out there. Is there, I know that there are some states that don't have access to other states' records when they're looking somebody up, especially when it's when they pull somebody over and they're running their license. Like Massachusetts can only look at Massachusetts driving records, for example. Maybe, I don't know. I'm just saying. Is that the case here? Was it a universal check on her license? Do you know?
Well, we know that New Hampshire and Massachusetts have reciprocity, so I'm assuming, and this is just my assumption, that the officer could have seen other states or New Hampshire's status of her license when he ran it in Massachusetts.
Gotcha. Okay, so that is a very workable theory, and knowing that someone would have to go up there in person, and you're right, it is about halfway between Boston and, like, if you were to travel to Lincoln or that area. What's come of that since the episode has been aired? Has anybody provided any further information on that?
Well, let me just take it back a step.
Okay.
So, like I said, I wasn't aware that she had the speeding ticket, and my dad was kind of cloudy, so we weren't really sure why she got the speeding ticket to begin with. So I happened to go home to Hanson, and my dad has this whole locker full of all of Mara's stuff. And in there is this box of letters, like I'm talking hundreds of letters, and they're all from Bill, her boyfriend at the time. And so I'm like, you know what? There might be some information in these letters that I could use. So I took them back with me to Richmond, and I slowly started to go through them. And I found two that reference Bill being up in New Hampshire that July with Mara and my dad. And so it was July 27th, I believe, and then another one on August 3rd. So I have it in writing with the dates on it, you know, saying that Bill was up there. And so now we know why Mara was up there in July in 2003. So I sent all that information to Chuck so that he would have it, and because he wasn't sure why she was up there either. And then I mentioned it to my dad, and he's like, oh, yeah, we were up there. We climbed so-and-so, and Bill was there. And, yeah, so that kind of – it was a long process to figure all that out and piece all that together, but it finally came together. But in terms of has anything else happened since then, what happened was I told Chuck West before Aaron put it out in her podcast. And I think it was just something that Chuck was able to, I'm not going to say cross off the list, but maybe potentially he could, because he knew why she was up there.
I see. And the theory is that she received the speeding ticket en route to that trip with your father and with Bill.
Well, we think that she was driving from the Lincoln, North Conway, Bartlett area to Boston Logan to drop Bill off for his flight, and then she had the next week off, so then she was going back up to New Hampshire to spend the next week with my dad in New Hampshire. So it sounds like Bill was there for that weekend. Mara was driving to Boston early on a Sunday morning, dropped him off, and then turned around and was speeding like crazy on the way back up to New Hampshire.
Okay. Yeah. And so she took 93 south to go drop Bill off at Logan, and then she turned around and headed back up 93 towards the White Mountains. And so Hooksett is, again, it's southern New Hampshire near Concord or Manchester. So it's at least an hour probably from the White Mountains.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But yeah, so that makes sense that it's en route.
And this was in the Saturn that she received the speeding ticket?
No, it was It was in my dad's Corolla, the new Corolla.
Gotcha.
Yep. And that was also odd when Chuck said, he asked me, do you know why she would have been in your dad's car? I was like, no, I have no idea. But now that you can kind of take a step back and put all the pieces together, she was like, hey, Dad, I got to go to the airport. I'm going to take your Corolla and I'm going to be right back.
Yeah.
And then in Bill's letter, he said, hey, it's something he referenced. Hey, I know you've been up there for another week. And she would have been off in that summer anyway from UMass. So it makes sense. But in terms of, is that 100% the reason why she was heading to New Hampshire on February 9th, 2004? I don't know.
I would say it's probably 98%.
Yeah, it's possible. Because, yeah. You know, like I said before, nobody knows why she went up there and she didn't tell anybody. So all of this is speculation.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. I feel like maybe she would have mentioned it, though, if it was something like that, you know?
Well, and that's what I said to Aaron. I was like, maybe she wouldn't have mentioned it because she shouldn't have been driving the Saturn anywhere.
Mm. Yeah.
And especially she should not have been driving the Saturn 2 hours north to New Hampshire.
Yeah.
At the very least, I think it's interesting to think about anything that she did prior to the accident that shows her as being a human being. I think that it's important for us to continually come back to that before this becomes a folktale.
Yeah, I agree. And this is where I differ from my dad. So my dad doesn't think, and not only my dad, there's other people that don't think anything that she did prior to the February 9th matters. I disagree with that. I think there are factors, there are circumstances that put her in a state of mind to make a dumb decision, which she did. It was a dumb decision to do what she did. So I agree with you in that. We do need to look at what she did leading up to February 9th.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point and consideration now, yeah. Speaking of Bill, I know he was kind of the subject of an episode of ours a little while ago. What were your thoughts on that information?
Well, my thoughts on Bill have never changed. I've known Bill 20 plus years. I did not like Bill for some decisions he made as a young man when he was with Mara. Do I think Bill harmed Mara? No. So in terms of the latest, I don't even know what to call them, allegations. Are they allegations?
I think it's safe to say allegations.
Yeah, the latest allegations with the affair and the mistress. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a judge. I don't know. I'm going to let the lawyers and judges and professionals handle that. Is it disturbing? Yes, of course it's disturbing. But do I think it has anything to do with Mara being harmed on February 9th? No, because we know that Bill was at Fort Sill. And there is some discussion that maybe Bill wasn't at Fort Sill. Well, I can tell you he was at Fort Sill because that's just how the Army works. You can't just, as a lieutenant in the Army, you can't just leave. I know that because when I got the call that Mara was missing, I couldn't just leave, and I was also a lieutenant in the Army.
Right. So someone in that position could, you know, even if they were in a position of rank, I guess, they can't just take off whenever they want if something like that happened. Yeah.
No, there's no special privileges. And in fact, that's what's great about the Army is there's regulations and there's policy and there's standards, and those have to be followed. Otherwise, why the hell do you have them? So I feel very confident that Bill was at Fort Sill on February 9th. I mean, you can look at his phone records. He got a flight. There's everything that we know points to him being at Fort Sill. But then again, I hear and see banter online about Bill's cleared and the family cleared him. Nobody is cleared until Mara's found, until we know what happened to Mara. I challenge people to look at everybody. Look at me. Look at my dad. Look at anyone.
Yeah, it's also puts a very unnecessary and unfair pressure on you and your family when there are people saying that you have officially done anything. When you haven't you're not law enforcement, you can't clear somebody, you know, but it's got to be tough to look at those comments and want things to be over, but at the same time you can't definitively say anything.
Right. And at the same time my opinion doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably respectfully. I think your opinion matters a lot, just in general. I feel like things that you say, I feel like people, I think it goes a long way. I think it resonates when people hear your voice. But, you know, what I get what you're saying. You're saying whatever you say really doesn't matter to the facts if it's like far flung speculation.
Well, to the goal here, and the goal here is to find Mara. So, us talking about some mistress and some affair that Bill had in 2014, whenever it was, that's extraneous to the goal of finding Mara.
Yeah.
Unless we think that Bill did harmed Mara, in which case I would think that the cold case unit and the law enforcement would also see that and in their official capacity do whatever they need to do against somebody who they think is a suspect. It's not for me to do, and it's not for the online community to do. It's for law enforcement to do, the judges and the lawyers.
Yeah, exactly. And every day we learn something personally. Tim and I learn something by doing this show. Every day we figure out what we need to do and what we don't need to do. Sometimes we might overstep certain lines that were blurry at the time, you know, thinking that something was being done and being pushed in the right direction. But, you know, I guess ultimately you just sort of do what you think is best at the time. And I mean, It's not so much like an apology for making mistakes, but it's like sort of like a bear with us type thing. We don't mean to allow people to connect dots that we weren't thinking they would connect. I don't know if that made any sense.
Yeah, I mean I get where you're going with that.
Yeah, I mean I think by all accounts, you know, his alibi is rock solid. And I think we did say that when we spoke about him. But I agree, an affair is not reason to bring Bill's name up at all. It was more his name in the court documents, specifically why we, you know, thought it was okay to talk about.
Yeah. And I just have to say it, but that's the true definition of an affair. What Mara had as a 21-year-old, which has been pushed as an affair, she was not married. It was not an affair. That is not the correct usage of affair. A 21-year-old girl having relations with other people in an unmarried status. It's not what she wasn't an affair.
Oh, my God. I've said that so many times. Like, I can't tell you how many times we see words like that and you feel like you're, you know, getting really hair splitty with it and focusing on semantics, but it goes a long way when someone sees the word affair as opposed to a relationship. Or, you know, and you see affair and all of a sudden you've created this image of a person that is not deserving. You know, it's the same with people saying Mora was drunk when she was driving that night. There's no indication that she was drunk. There was an indication that there was drinking, but there was no indication that she was drunk. And there's no indication that she was even like definitely drinking. You know, mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of those semantics are downplayed and it's just like, oh, well, I misspoke, you know. And also, I feel super guilty even saying that I'm frustrated with certain things while talking to you. I can't imagine how frustrated you must be.
Yeah, I know. I mean... I've gotten used to it. I've gotten good at brushing stuff off, and recently I've gotten better at it. And I sometimes catch myself trying to please everybody and trying to harmonize the online community. How could I ever harmonize the online community? That cannot happen. In me trying to do that and trying to please everyone, number one, I lose stability. Number two, it's an impossible task. And number three, it detracts from finding Mara. And other people can be distracted and they can focus on this white noise, but I can't be. I need to really get better at focusing on finding Mara and doing these things behind the scenes and doing this testing that we're doing and things like that. And you know, my dad is in his late 70s. I don't have the luxury of time to focus on what the online community wants me to do because I'm never going to please them.
Yeah, you actually said something to us a couple of weeks ago about not blowing like a tumbleweed with the direction that a certain, you know, wind is going based on the topic of the moment in the online community, where you just have to stay your ground and keep your course and not blow from side to side. One, that was a great analogy. And I think what you just said there is a wonderful definition of that, which is you have to stay focused and you can't have those distractions because it's not doing you any good. It takes you off your focus.
Right. And I hate to say it, but every day I feel like I'm getting more and more like my dad, getting unapologetic and just, you know, just not having time for any of the extraneous stuff. But I have to be that way. And I don't want, I want to make everyone happy. I really want that, but I want to find Mara more. So I've got to be that person that makes the hard decisions. I've got to be the person that takes the blame. It's on my shoulders. I'm not going to get everything right. I haven't so far, and I'm going to make mistakes and I'm going to make the wrong decisions. But as long as I'm doing it with my focus and my azimuth pointed towards finding Mara and doing everything I can within my power to make that happen soon for my dad is what I have to do.
Yeah. Well, well put. And you're making more correct decisions than you are incorrect decisions. So for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, Julie, I think you're doing a great job. So just want to let you know that that's how we feel. So
it's not easy. You guys know it. It is not easy. It is not easy. And there's no guide for this. Like the things that I have to do, and Curtis and I and Kathleen and Freddie, we've got to make decisions that other people can't even imagine having to make those decisions. But
yeah. And people, literally no one has been in the same situations that you have been in. So that,
Well, you mentioned Kathleen and Fred Jr. and Curtis. How are those guys doing? How are they holding up?
We're all just plugging. I mean, 16 years is a long time, but actually we've, throughout the 16 years, we've always had something going. We've always had some sort of hope. I mean, there's been ups and downs where there's been periods where we're like, okay, what next? But we've always found something next, thanks to my dad mostly leading the charge on that. But that's what keeps us going, is focusing on what's next, because we can't focus on, a poor me, let's have a pity party. That's not going to help us find Mara. And it, like I said, it's not about us. But we support each other. We battle each other. Curtis and I battle head to head, and we disagree on a lot of things. But at the end of the day, we want what's best for Mara, and we want to do what's best to find her. And so we use that as our guide. Yeah.
You have often said, this is, I think, my last question or my last point. You say someone knows something. What's your thought process behind that? And I don't know if you can even answer that. I get inspired when you say that about this, and it makes me believe that somebody does know something. Is there a scenario you've ever imagined where somebody has said something or would be able to be convinced into talking?
Yes, all the time. I truly, truly, with every fiber in my being, think that there's somebody out there on this planet that knows, maybe not exactly what happened, but they know a piece. And then I think there's another person that knows another piece. And so when I say, what can the community do? That is, continue to talk about Mara. She's not going anywhere. I'm not letting her go anywhere. My family's not letting it go anywhere. You guys aren't letting it go anywhere. It's to get those people with those small little pieces that they think may not be important to come forward and tell law enforcement, tell us, so that we can piece that together. Because I just can't understand how Mara could have went missing with not a single person knowing anything. I agree that somebody does know something, and we just got to get to that person, those people, or test those samples and figure it out.
Yeah.
There's something out there. It's my hope. I'm hopeful. I don't know how I'm hopeful. It's been 16 years and we've had nothing. We haven't found a single thing, but I'm hopeful. And it's because of the community and you guys, and the support that we get is incredible. And I think one of these days someone's going to offer up that piece and we're going to be able to put this puzzle together.
There's no such thing as a perfect crime. There's only apathy, right? So anyone can commit a crime. It's only in a period of time that goes by before that becomes approached with some level of apathy. I don't think that that's happening here whatsoever. And I think if people continue to talk about Mara, like you're saying, talk about her, talk about the family searches, talk about the independent searches, talk about samples that were collected that are being sent to be tested. If anybody overhears something, if anyone's up in the area and the perpetrator or perpetrators are up in the area and they happen to overhear a conversation about listening to an interview with you or seeing a post from you that you put out there about samples being tested, you know, talk louder about that. You never know who's listening. You never know who's overhearing your conversation. And that these people might get nervous. These people might think, hey, you know, my friend told me something about this, or told me that they knew somebody who might know something about this, and now they're testing samples, and maybe they want to get ahead of the, you know, get ahead of it, and talk to the law enforcement up there and say, I overheard this conversation, and I know there are samples that are being tested. If it comes back positive for this, you know, I mean, it's like you're not just talking about the case in a vacuum or in like an arbitrary way. Talk about it so people overhear it.
And you never really know where information can come from. There's a lot of people out there who have looked into this case for years, and they may have a puzzle piece that we don't know of at this point.
So one of the things I want to talk about is the small army that I have of people that have no social media presence, zero. These people, most of them, their name has never been out there in the public, but they have helped my family so much, and they don't want anything for it. And these are the purest of the pure. These are the salt of the earth people that are doing this with the goal of just trying to find Mara. No publicity. They don't need content. They're not doing it for profit. They're not trying to be relevant. They're trying to find Mara. And there are also people that do have a social media presence, and we need a good mix of both of those. But what we don't want is to have all of these battling egos that kind of hoard information, because what is that doing? What is the purpose of hoarding information? I mean, if you've been on the case since day one and you have information that you haven't shared with the family or the cold case unit or someone, that's a problem. And it just kind of highlights what you're in it for. And so we have a couple personalities involved in this case that aren't forthcoming with their information. And it seems that they're only doing that so that when the time comes, or, you know, when the information is needed, that their name gets out there in the limelight. And that's not helpful. And I wish, you guys know my wish. My wish is that we could all get along and be one happy family.
Yes.
But I get it. I mean, that's a stretch. But if we had information, or if we have information, we got to share it. We can't just hoard it. We can't just put it in piles just for your own use. How is it helping Mara?
Yeah, you're right. It's not. And don't hold information for ransom, right? Don't say I have this, and it's not a give and tear quid pro quo. It's nothing like that. If you have information, for God's sake, like, deliver it to the appropriate channels. Mm-hmm.
So, Julie, recently there was a situation that arose with a moderator from the Facebook group, and without getting into too many details, I just wanted to ask what you as a family were doing with that information.
Right. So we have multiple people helping us, some in the public limelight, some not, as I just described. So we had a void after Helena passed away. Helena ran the Facebook pages, and she kind of was the captain of, or the conduit between the investigation, my dad, who has no social media presence, and the online community. So she started all of that. And we're very thankful that she did. The case would not be where it was without Helena. I'm sure you've heard my dad talk about how much he appreciates Helena and misses her. But at the time when, after she passed away, or even before, Scott was helping Helena with some of the back end stuff with the Facebook page. And before Facebook, I think we even had like a MySpace. I think MySpace was in back then, but also topics and things like that. So Scott would help Helena with that. And that was before I kind of stepped into my role as a more public role. And so there were some allegations that Scott was involved with that kind of came up recently, and they were disturbing. But at the same time, I didn't really know what to do. So we kind of had a family meeting, I guess you could say a virtual meeting, to try to figure out how do we handle situations like this? How do we determine who's qualified to help and who isn't? And I will tell you that it was very difficult, and it still is, because it's a fine line to see. Do we have to do background checks on people who want to help find Mara? I don't know. I mean, I don't want to have to do that. If people want to volunteer their time and try to help and are helping, then we welcome that help. It's been hard for me to publicly address this because it is a hard situation. And you know, Scott helps with moderate the Facebook group. So a lot of times Curtis and I get a bunch of just really crazy people sending in really crazy stuff. And so Scott mostly helps with that. And he also helps with a lot of the picture stuff and computer stuff that I'm not too savvy with.
Well, I think all you can do is do your best in that situation. That's, you know, also a situation that people don't come across very often. Like I get your point. You're not going to want to run a background check on everyone who wants to help. You're talking hundreds of people.
Right. And so that was what our decision was. And some people were concerned about tips going to unsavory people, but tips actually aren't going there. And we push for tips, and we've gotten many very significant tips into the family email account, and that's maramurrayfamilydirect@gmail.com. That's been our most significant source of actionable tips. So if people are worried about that, or the people focused on this Scott thing that has nothing to do with Mara, do I think Scott harms Mara? No. People focused on that maybe need to readjust their azimuth, kind of like I've have to do in difficult situations where you have to ask yourself, is he helping or is it a distraction? Yes, it is a distraction. But at the end of the day, he's helped my family with stuff behind the scenes that I too many times to name, and has given up his own personal time and money, tons of money, to help find Mara.
Yeah, and like you said before, there's no guidebook to all of this, and the charges or allegations, whatever we have to call them, they're so out of left field. Like no one could have predicted anything like that would happen, and just how one deals with processing that and how to move forward. Again, no guidebook on that. You just do the best you can in the situation.
Right. Another person I want to talk about is Erin Larkin. She's become the target of much internet anger lately, I guess you could say. But here's how I feel about Erin. I respect Erin. And Erin has put in hundreds and hundreds of hours into behind the scenes stuff, as well as, you know, on her podcast and online, to try to help find Mara. Do I think she has any ill intentions whatsoever? Not a chance. I respect her work. I think she has been treated unfairly. And it seems when she does stand up and try to correct the record, she's attacked. And like I said, that's unfair. And I have to say it, that I think you guys contributed a little bit to that. And I know Erin, and I know how hard she works, and I know how much she cares about Mara and my family. I don't want to just attack people that disagree with you or have a difference of opinion. And I want to say that to everyone in the community. You should, if you disagree with someone, you should listen to what they have to say, and read what supports their train of thought.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I think that a lot of lasting relationships, a lot of quality working relationships in any situation have disagreements. They have mistakes. They have stumbles. But it's how you recover from them. And we have talked to Erin separately, not online. And it's just a matter of figuring out where our balance is with her. And we're coming along. And I appreciate the criticism of us contributing to that. And, you know, just personally speaking, maybe there was emotional stuff that was said at the time, just, you know, without taking a step back and taking some time to think about it. And that is something that will be, you know, not done in the future, and hopefully corrected, not in the public eye, which is mm-hmm. just something that has to be over and over reinforced, that arguments and disagreements don't have to be done on the platform of Twitter, where a million other people can be the spectators. And there's no winners or losers with something like that.
Well, I have one more thing. It's kind of more of a positive spin.
Okay.
And you can plug it in wherever you want, but I'm going to talk about it. It's never been made public before, but I don't want to keep just hitting people over the head with the same crap. So this part that I'm about to talk about is nobody knows about it. So I'm about to share it. You ready for it?
I'm on the edge of my seat.
It's not earth shattering. It's just kind of like more of an emotional thing.
Okay.
Okay. So one of the meetings I had with Chuck West, we talked about a bunch of different things. And I've said before that some of the things that we discussed, I can't make public, but I am privy to some information that the public doesn't know. And I had a specific question in one of these meetings with Chuck. I wanted to know what Mara was listening to when the crash occurred. And so Mara had an external CD player. And in that CD player was this band that I hate to say it, that I didn't know about before, called the New Radicals. Have you guys heard of the New Radicals?
Great band.
Yes.
You have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
they had that one big song, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm in the minority here. But anyway, I wanted to get kind of a feel for what her frame of mind was while she's driving down. Because, you know, I don't have much left. And so I felt like, for me, I wanted to get in her mind and see where she was while she's driving down 112. And she's listening to this New Radicals song called Get What You Give. And so I've known about this for quite some time. I haven't ever shared it because it is something personal. And there's not much that, like I said, that I have left that is personal that I can have, or that my family can have. and the public can't tear apart. But if you listen to this song, it's really upbeat. It's kind of just like a carefree, just like happy song. And it brings me to tears every time I listen to it. And I just wanted to share that with everyone because it kind of puts you in the car with Mara. And it's really special to me, but I think that the community should know that.
You're gonna get what you give.